In a world on the brink of environmental catastrophe, we've come to realise that humankind is not superior to nature, but intimately bound up with it. In his new book, Contaminations: Beyond Dialectics in Modern Literature, Science and Film, Michael Mack shows how the division between man and nature is just one of many false separations that influence the way we think. In this podcast, Michael explains more about his philosophy, the role that literature plays in it, and how the concept of contaminated thought may help us to conceptualise climate change in particular. So I'm here with Michael Mack. Michael, the title of your book is Contaminations, which is quite an evocative word, isn't it? And it's one we usually use in a negative sense. So where did you get the idea for a project themed around the idea of contaminations?
Yes, thank you. It comes from a number of sources. One is what you could call modern Jewish thought, even though that doesn't feature in the book. But there are a number of modern Jewish thinkers, from Walter Benjamin, Gershom Scholem, to perhaps even Buber and Hannah Arendt, who tackled with the issue of negativity. But the immediate point of contact, as it were, in the book is the filmmaker and Italian poet and novelist and theorist and thinker, Pier Paolo Pasolini.
He might be someone who people haven't necessarily heard of. So do you want to explain a bit more? Why is he the touchstone?
There's one word which figures prominently in his oeuvre, in his films and in his novels and in his poetry, and that is the word scandalo, scandal. And he gave scandal, if you wish, a positive spin, if anyone can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And it is, I mean, he focused, first of all, on so-called negative figures, lowlifes, and contaminated their vulgarity, if you wish, with a secret. He did this in films like Acatona, for example, where there's a fighting scene and, you know, lowlife terms like pimp or, you know, are used. And there is there's an autotune and the music accompanying the fight is from Bach's Matthew Passion, which is holy music, so you have the profane contaminated with the sacred. And he was, in a way, he was trying to question what we take to be negative, to be bad, to be disgusting. Not that it is no longer disgusting, but to show that it contains perhaps what is normally considered to be its opposite, namely the graceful or the beautiful.
So when John Keats wrote that beauty is truth, truth is beauty, he only got half of the picture there. You'd say the ugly, the contaminated, the low life, as you put it, in relation to Pasolini. Those two contain a sort of human essential truth that we have to engage with and indeed can engage with through literature or art in a way that we don't necessarily in our ordinary lives.
And which is part, perhaps, of beauty. And indeed, one can read Keats's beauty is truth, truth is beauty. That's all you need to know. We can read it in a different way. We can read that, you know, the beautiful implies the ugly. Or there is a truth that is ugly and beauty.
Well, if we turn a bit more specifically to one of the major themes in your book, which is the way in which contaminations and engagement with both the beautiful and the ugly are seen in nature, and nature in particular in an age of climate change and environmental degradation and crisis and pollution. Is that a way in which you think contaminations works?
Yes, in a way. I mean, the thesis of the book, put into a nutshell about negativity and contamination, is that, I mean, there's always something that cannot be purely gotten rid of. If you, for example, if you think about oil spills or, you know, disasters, our approach is to clean it up immediately and then get on with it, clean it up, and that's it. But the book argues that these ideas of being able to, you know, to clean up and get over the negative are actually delusory, that there's always something that remains. And indeed, it argues for a completely new approach to what we consider to be negative, one that is not so much fighting the negative. I mean, for example, one example with oil, I mean, how does this relate to real examples? With the oil spill, for example, when you fight an oil spill, you use chemicals fighting the oil spill. And it's actually often the chemicals, like in the Gulf of Mexico, which were actually more negative in its lasting effect on the Gulf than the actual oil. You know, it's these chemicals kind of killing off the oil, as it were, that are apparently can be more troubling than the oil in the long run. Mm. That's one example.
Mm. So our desire to do good for nature backfires and is actually contaminated by negative repercussions, isn't it?
It can be, or it can also be a psychological, emotional, feel-good factor, as is the case now. It's a fiction example in France's Freedom, where there's this alliance between someone who is greener than Greenpeace, Walter Berglund, the hero of the France's novel, and a coal magnate who is out to save a rare bird species, and a top mountain removal, which obviously is there to promote coal mining in the Upper Leichen Mountains in America. The Birdwatch reservoir is an excuse for toppling the mountains, which is of course necessary for the coal mining and is really the cause of climate change. But this greener than Greenpeace person goes full into this bird saving mode, even though it ironically kind of furthers the coal mining, which in the long run obviously will then enhance CO2 emissions and climate change. Mm. And it's this, I mean, there is in interesting quote in Franzen's Freedom, where Berglund goes on to say, when his wife questions him about, you know, but isn't that bad for global warming, you know, removing the mountaintops and mining for coal in order to save a bird species. And he says, I meant that world population and energy consumption are going to have to fall drastically at some point. We are past sustainable even now. So this is kind of the apocalyptic argument here. Once the collapse comes, there's going to be a window of opportunity for ecosystems to recover, but only if there is any nature left. So point is to create nature reserves. So the big question is, how much of the planet gets destroyed before the collapse? Do we completely use it up, cut down every tree and sterilize every ocean and then collapse? Or are there going to be any unwrecked strongholds that survive? So here you have classical kind of what I call negative dialectical thinkings, which focuses on the negative, in this case, climate change, and then turns it into a positive. We have nature collapses, but then we need to preserve a spot of nature which is pure and healthy, you know, for like the bird watch space where mountaintops are removed, and then with that kind of clean spot we turn the negative again into the positive. Mm-hmm. And that is of course delusory. It is this uncritical and unreflective environmental discourse which other critics like Timothy Morton have in mind, and Nietzsche has all too often been hypostasized as a pure and innocent image or notion cut off from the defilement of society, culture and humanity. And it's just an approach aware of the figure of condemnation allows us to see that these kind of good sounding kind of undertakings might actually also be contaminated with the negativity they're setting out to fight.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of the hypocrisy, or the accusations of hypocrisy, that surrounded the Paris climate change talks, where you have world leaders from all corners of the globe travelling tens of thousands of miles to a conference to hopefully solve the problem of climate change, but of course in the process burning up vast tons of carbon in the flights there. And there's almost a sense of helplessness, isn't there, that whatever we do to try and combat climate change, there will always be some sort of repercussion through the very process or the action that we're trying to take to alleviate it.
And that's another aspect of the book, you know, relationship between action and perception. The two have normally, traditionally, been opposed, and the book gives a reading of novels by Henry James, like most of all, The Portrait of a Lady, which for the first time really problematizes the traditional opposition between action and perception, which is now redeemed by the discovery of neuroscience, of mirror neurons, in neuroscientific recent discoveries.
Hmm. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean not everyone might be familiar with A Portrait of a Lady, but it's about someone who sets out to be free and ends up rather compromised, let's put it that way. And she's very desperate to avoid being a reader. She wants to be active. She wants not to be seen as bookish. And then she falls into the trap, as it were, of Osmond, Gilbert Osmond, and Madame Merle, whom she mistakes to be innocent, but because she doesn't read them well in real life. So it's almost like the reading of books kind of doesn't necessarily fulfill, but may hold out the opportunity to provide a guide, or not just a guide, a map, as it were, for acting in the real world. And that is what The Portrait of a Lady is, I think, mainly about, you know, how we demote contemplation, reading, thinking to our peril when we are so obsessed with an active, or what Buber calls political life, because the actions might actually backfire if they are not first enacted in the mind or in the perceptive sphere.
It's quite striking. You mentioned The Portrait of a Lady, and we've also mentioned romantic poets. And of course, you know, both Henry James and romantic poetry precede the modern environmental movement. And another book that you talk about also precedes it, and that's Herman Melville's Moby Dick, the story of the great white whale and Captain Ahab's quest for this mythical beast. How does that relate to the idea of contaminations?
Yes, I mean, Moby Dick is so central to the theory I'm trying to propose about the figure of contamination, because it is a literary text which undermines a traditional scientific concept, and that is that there is order in nature, that there is something called natural order. And through the whale, who is a symbol of nature, the disorder of nature becomes, you know, apparent. And it's not just the nature, it's also the human. I mean, the human is revealed to be intrinsically contaminated with the natural. You know, Ahab, out to revenge the whale, actually becomes almost like a prothesis of the whale. I mean, of course, Ahab's leg is cut off. It's almost like he's an appendix to the whale trying to hunt him. Yeah. Ironically, he's already tied to the whale while he's trying to find him. So there's a contamination of the human and the natural, which are normally opposed, of the ordered and the disordered, which is there in Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. Straight from page one, when Ishmael talks about his spleen, which is of course then refigured in Ahab's spleen and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the what we take to be normal disintegrates into the spleen. Of course, Moby Dick is about oil. It's about the hunt for whales. That's kind of the larger contextual picture. And the hunt for whales is about, you know, what was the first kind of oil in 19th century capitalism, before the discovery of oil in the ground. It was the oil of whales, that procured the oil for, let's say, lights at night, reading lamps. So it's the whole Enlightenment is there, which turns to become very messy, you know, during the course of Moby Dick. It's about the contamination of light, of Enlightenment with irrationality, of order with disorder, of nature and humanity, and many, many other more contaminated bits in the novel. It's really a book about the figure of contamination.
Mm. So we can certainly say in conclusion that literature isn't going to solve the problems with climate change. It isn't necessarily even going to make us better human beings, better equipped to solve the problems with climate change, but it is going to point out the contradictions and the complexities of the process insofar as we can try and overcome it over the next 10, 15, 100 years before we do drown under rising sea levels.
But this awareness is itself, of course, an action. This awareness is itself necessary for whatever we want to do or not to do.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mack, thank you ever so much. Contaminations is available now through Edinburgh University Press, and there's more about this available on our website at www.readdurhamenglish.wordpress.com.
Thank you, Alistair. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast. If you would like to comment on the podcast you have just listened to, or if you want to download more of our podcasts, visit our blog at www.readdurhamenglish.wordpress.com.